But for no reason. Okay. All right, I'll try to keep my eyes on this. How's Paradise Lost going?
Good, better. I like it.
Good. Say more.
Well, I don't understand it too well. I thought I wouldn't. I tried reading it like 2 years ago. I was completely lost.
Uh-huh.
But now it makes a lot more sense on my own.
Okay.
A lot of wisdom in it too. Like little like quotes in it that are really cool.
Like what?
At least it's like devil to devil, conqueror to polar.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that. I don't know exactly. It's book two, but...
Yeah, so that the devils are able to talk to each other, they can do philosophy, they can talk about poetry, and this should shame us.
Yeah, exactly. And it's talking about, like, yeah, kind of wasting the earth, each other to destroy, as if, which might induce us to accord, man had not hellish foes, and now besides, a day and night for his destruction wait. I thought that was pretty cool.
All right, good. How are other people finding it?
I understood book two, I think, a bit better than I did book one, and I think that mainly has to do with, like, where I went to go read book two, it had, like, that little summary at the top, and
uh-huh.
I think reading that allowed me to follow along a bit better.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that, and I also just enjoy the concept of the demons in general. I just think it's really cool what he chose to do with them.
Uh-huh.
Instead of just, you know, portraying them as, like, you know, what they usually do, just pure evil.
Yeah. Yeah, evil and nasty and shallow.
Mm.
But what you're getting here are figures who are quite the opposite of all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Even the shallowest of them. Oh, here he is. Okay. So, let me just... Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, so I'm just going to point you to the class. I think, yeah, it makes sense. Okay, maybe that'll be distracting. I'll put you up here. Okay, you get Massimo's back. You got his back, man. That's good. Okay, yeah. So, how are other people finding it?
I'm a bit confused because I wasn't here last class, so I'm not sure what we're talking about.
Okay, so Paradise Lost, for today, you were supposed to... We ended up talking about Paradise Lost last class, and I gave some background on it, but for today, you were supposed to have at least started reading the first two books of Paradise Lost, which is what we're doing in this class. Like, I think you should have them... You should have both books of Paradise Lost, both of the first two books of Paradise Lost, read by Tuesday. So have you started reading it?
No.
No, okay. Have other people started reading it?
Mm-hmm.
How are you finding it?
I thought the dialogue between the demons and stuff was really cool, especially when they were talking about, like, whether to wage war on heaven or not.
Uh-huh.
But my only qualm is that I think it can be too much. I feel like every time they introduce Satan, they have to give him, like, background, like, oh, he's darkness, he's this and this and this, and I think it can be a little bit corny.
Okay, I think this may be the first time anyone called Milton corny, but you're agreeing.
Even though, like,
no.
Well, okay. Even though he's put, like, he's the protagonist in this,
uh-huh.
Which I think is good, I still think it's like too, I don't know, that's my personal opinion, there's like too much intro every time.
Can you give an example?
I don't have to.
Oh no, okay, so really... Since we're looking carefully at poetry, print out and bring whatever it is that we're looking at. What do other people think? Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I really like the lore behind sin and death and
uh-huh.
Satan and, like, how he breaks out of hell, or breaks out, he doesn't really break out, he's, like, permitted. But it's just, like, it really is weird lore. I mean, if I got it right, Satan did he have sex with his own daughter?
Yes.
Okay, so he had sex with his own daughter who sinned, and sin gave birth to death, and death continuously rapes his mother, sin.
Right.
And then, so, and she's the washer of the gates of hell.
Yeah. So okay. God has assigned her and death to guard hell, which yeah. doesn't seem like the best.
Yeah. It's a weird lore, because I was like, wait, how is his daughter? And it made sense after, like, okay, it's a weird lore story, but it's still really, I don't know, I like epic poetry because of this, it's just really random and cool lore, but.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I like that part too, actually. This is technically the third time I've read Paradise Lost.
Wow.
I consistently like that part. I think it's interesting the way it says, like, an involuntary byproduct of Satan, and it kind of seems like in this universe, you know, sin is like inevitable. Like he didn't try to make sin; she just kind of was created. And I like the way that it mirrors like Eve's creation out of Adam. And I just always thought that was interesting.
Yeah. So if you know the biblical story, which isn't in the first two books, but it's that. Adam says, I'm all alone, and God says, okay, just go to sleep for a minute, and then takes Adam's rib out of his side and forms Eve out of it, and then you have Adam and Eve. And sin is, where does sin come from?
Pops out of Satan's head.
Yeah, Satan has a terrible headache. And suddenly sin pops out of his head. And at first everyone is freaked out, but then they find her desirable. Milton does an interesting little pun there where he says, where he basically gives a sort of English etymology for her name. It's not a true etymology, but it's she is a sign portentous. That is, the very fact that she popped out of Satan's head freaked everyone out, and they thought of her as a sign portentous. But then that word sign turns into sin, and as they get used to her, they decide they like her. So the idea would be, if you're reading it allegorically, as you get used to sin, it becomes more attractive. The first time you commit a sin, you feel all guilty, and I should never have done this, and I'll never do it again. But then as you get used to it, you just you like the positive experiences, and you forget about the negative ones. So that's sort of the allegorical story he's telling. But then there's a third pairing. Again, in Paradise Lost, not in the first two books, but there is Eve comes out of Adam, sin comes out of Satan, and can you guess what a third version of that might be?
Death comes out of God.
Death comes out of God. I like that. Death comes out of sin, though. Satan and sin have sex, and death is born. The Son of God comes out of God. So all of... what sin says to this is just background for you. This is not what we're focusing on, but just to get a sense of where Paradise Lost is going. Sin says to Satan that that he sees his own image in herself, and that she is what is it? Thyself in me, thy perfect image viewing. So Satan looks at sin. And he has a narcissistic, who's Narcissus, anyone?
The guy who looks at his own reflection.
Who falls in love with his own reflection. So why do we call people narcissists? What does that mean if you call someone a narcissist?
Yeah, so.
Say it again.
You love yourself to like an extreme extent, because like narcissists look to the pool until you die.
Right, but yeah.
It mirrors it when Eve sees her own reflection.
And... yeah, so that's another thing that happens. So that explicit story... which is Narcissus falling in love with his own reflection, which he sees in a pool of water, is going to be adapted by Milton when Eve, after she's created, she doesn't know where she is. She's totally baffled, but she sees a pool of water, and she looks into it, and she really likes this beautiful reflection that she sees. And then Adam shows up behind her and he says, "Eve, Eve, that's just your reflection. I'm the guy." And she turns around and then she says, "No." And she goes back to looking at her own reflection. But then after a while she says, "But after a while I learned to love men. You know, it's kind of hard, but I did learn to do it." But Eve is comes out of Adam, sin comes out of Satan, and sin specifically says that Satan sees his own reflection in sin, and the Son of God comes out of God in the same way. And God in Paradise Lost calls the Son his image. That is, that one of the ideas in Paradise Lost is that there is God the Father, whom no one can look at. Just as in Exodus, no one can look at God. There is God the Father who is ungazable at because he is too bright. And then there's his Son, who is the image of God, and it is to the Son that people can, the S-O-N Son, that people can address themselves. And God actually sees, Milton says that God sees in the Son the best image of himself. So there are these three figures, and it's part of, if you do read all of Paradise Lost, and if you do try to figure out whose side Milton is on, which, as I mentioned before, is the great debate about Paradise Lost, it's worth trying to figure out, if you can figure out, how you can say, yeah, Satan's relation with sin, that's really bad. He's a narcissist. Sin stands for his own narcissism. But God's relation with his Son, so we have sign, sin, and Son, God's relation with his Son, it's different. Then you have to figure out how it's different, if you think it's different in Paradise Lost. So these are all issues in Paradise Lost. I'm just telling you that these are issues so that you can have some sense of what he's already introducing in the first two books. The extent to which Satan appears as a heroic figure, you use the word protagonist, the extent to which Satan appears as a heroic figure is one that we have to decide, is he really heroic or not? Whose side ultimately are we on in Paradise Lost? What we were talking about on Tuesday was the question, is God automatically just? Is something just because God says it is? Or does God say something is just because God can recognize what's just rather than defining it? What he can do is he can be reliable as to what's just and what's unjust. But one of the things, again, just this is sort of background of Paradise Lost. One of the things that God says in book three, book three takes place in heaven. So the first two books are take place in hell, and at the end of book two, Satan finally manages to get out of hell and head towards this world, towards earth. Then we go to heaven, and book three takes place in heaven, and it's God and the angels and the Son of God talking, and God says, you know what? Here's what Satan's going to do. He's going to try to tempt Adam and Eve to eat an apple and to be disobedient. And not only that, he's going to succeed because humans are ingrates. Now, Adam and Eve there are being totally innocent. They're not doing anything. This is what you have to imagine this is like, is you have a parent looking at a newborn child in her crib and the parent saying of the newborn child, "Look at that ingrate. I know what she's going to be like as an adolescent. I am so pissed." That's basically what God is doing in Paradise Lost, is he is calling Adam and Eve ingrates before they're ingrates, before they've done anything wrong. He's not, let's say, if you're against him, you would say he's unappealing. If you're for him, you might say something like he is strict. He knows what's going to happen. He's just. He's demanding. And then he comes up with this assertion. He says, man will hearken to Satan's glozing lies, and he will fall. I made him sufficient to have stood, yet free to fall, and he will fall. And then he's going to have to die. He's going to have to be punished. I created him. Then he did this to me, or he will have done this to me. And he will have to die. And then he says, unless someone else is willing to pay the price, someone else will die for him. Someone else will pay what God calls the rigid satisfaction, death for death. Which is maybe not that easy to justify if you're trying to justify the ways of God to men. Someone's got to die, and he's guilty. Adam and Eve are guilty, so they have to die, unless someone who's innocent is willing to die instead. And then it'll all be set up. Yeah.
But isn't the guilt like just majorly placed on God himself? Because if he's like all powerful, then he should have the power to stop Adam from falling and Eve from like being tempted. But he chooses not to, which means that this is his design, and that like all that like they have to suffer, he's like, oh, you are guilty. I've known you're going to be guilty all this time. It's such a shame that, you know, you're going to have to die. I mean, unless somebody dies for you in your stead. Like, it's all just him being like, yeah. It's so sad, you know? If you guys just didn't do what I knew you guys were going to do, this would have gone a lot better. Like, it's just, it's weird to, like, see how it's claimed as, like, just when obviously it's, like, I mean, like, God is, like, a different being from humanity. So, like, seeing through his point of view is, like, near impossible, in my opinion. But, like, it's also, like, it seems a lot less just and more, like, very cruel.
Uh-huh.
And, like, very manipulative to, like, know you have the power to do this and know that like you created a being that does all these things, and to be able to claim that you understand and know what this being is going to do and the ramifications of it, and to allow it to continue to happen.
Yeah. Okay, so
I don't think he's just at all.
All right. So if you don't think that, that means that in a sense Milton has failed. Or at least his narrator has failed, because maybe they're not the same thing, at doing what he says he wants to do, which is to justify the ways of God to men. So what he, this is what we talked about on Tuesday, what he opens the poem by doing is saying, it might take a little convincing to convince you that the way God acts is just. And that, think about how radical that is, that here is someone who is in a society full of believers, where you could get burned at the stake if you weren't a believer, who says that he is writing a poem retelling the story of Genesis. And then he's saying, because I actually want to show that God's behavior is not evil. Now, that is, he's not trying to convince the unconverted that God isn't evil, but it's as though he's saying, this actually might be kind of hard to show that God is not evil. And so I'm going to write this poem in order to do just that, to justify the ways of God to men. We might be sufficiently used to that idea, partly because of Milton, that we don't see how radical it is that he's going to say, there's God, and now I'm going to try to show that God is good. It's like, it's not automatic. And then for you, he doesn't succeed. And part of the question is, does Milton want to succeed? So it could be the sort of thing. This is something actually that some people think some of Trump's lawyers did, is that they thought their client was just wrong. And so they didn't do what they claimed they were trying to do, which is to prevent, to block certain testimony. This happened during the summer. So it's like God says, yeah, it's like Milton says, I'm God's lawyer, and I'm going to try to show that he's okay, and then he doesn't do it. So that's one possibility. Yeah.
I mean, like, if you wanted to convince, like, his readers that, like, God is great, and God is good, and God is, like, I mean, honestly, like, if I was willing, not to say I would twist the narrative and make it, like, God propaganda, but, like, honestly, you could have made God a lot more empathetic. Or,
yeah.
Like, sympathetic. Because, like, the way that, like, you feel for something is by connecting to it. And honestly, I just, like, from what I hear, I can't connect to God at all, because, like, if I knew someone was going to do a bad thing, and that bad thing's going to happen because of it, I'd probably be like, you know, maybe be a little nosy, get in the situation, like, you know, try and prevent it. If it still goes bad, I'd be like, well, at least I tried. But, like, by creating God as, like, above thee, not even, like, involved, really just, like, letting things play out. Like, it's like he's watching, like, mice run through, like, a maze. And there's, like, there's no sympathy and there's no empathy. Like you said, he like calls like Adam like an ingrate. Like he's basically just like, oh, like damn you. And I'm like, but you made him like that. Like you made him like this, and he's doing actions that you predetermined for him, and you're not stopping him from doing these predetermined actions. And Adam doesn't have the power to go against your predetermined actions. So anything Adam does is your fault. And so like this is, there's like no, like in my opinion, there's no like desire for empathy or sympathy towards God. It makes it like extremely difficult to ever feel like bad for him, because it's like it's just watching like a man play with like the tools in a box, like honestly. And it's not like invigorating or like, oh my God, like, you know, if like God was like, oh my poor Adam, you know, he's fallen to temptation, my dear boy, my sweet cheese, my rotten soldier, if only he could have, like, you know, I could have stopped this, or like, you know, if I had warned him, he still did it. I did my best, but no, like, it's just, he's kind of like, I'm going to let him fall, and I'm going to let all this, like, that stuff happen. So it's just like, in my opinion, I think Milton messed up, or Milton was like, I want to make God a good guy, wink, wink. Mm-hmm. But, like,
yeah.
I just feel like the point of this, that, like, when we talked about last class, is that, like, Adam, you have the agency to choose what they do, and if God made them like always good, it would take away from that actually being good, and that would just be like the norm.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why he's not like playing more of a part in like ensuring they do the right thing. But
I mean, but like if his whole thing was like bad things have to happen so good things exist despite that, he could have been like nicer about it. Then, like, you know, like, this is a shame. This is going to have to happen, but, like, you're going to see, like, in the grand plan, like, the masterful ending of this, it's going to be great. So, women, you're going to suffer through childbirth. This is totally unnecessary, but it's going to happen. All of this is going to happen, you guys. You're going to suffer. You're going to die. It's going to be horrible. But in the end, it'll be great. But, like, there's no pep talk, or there's no, like, look, it hurts me as much as it hurts you. Like, there's like no connection of him being like, or like at least like an inch of like remorse. Like, you know, it's just like he's like, I'm gonna make the bad things happen so the good things have meaning, and that's just how it's gonna play out. That's how things are gonna be. And it doesn't even seem like he brings great value to good things. It seems more like he wants the bad things. He's like, oh yes, like the goodness that I've preached, like, you know, the goodness that attracts you to like me, that makes you like better. But like, if you wanted goodness, you could have been like, hey, you know, Adam, maybe you should think about this, you know? Like, maybe don't bite that apple. Or, like, you know, he could have been like, there's consequences to these actions, no one. But it's just, like, there's a lot of, like, agency when there's, like, no actual agency. And he's like, yeah, like, go on, like, run around, like, make your choices, but at the end of the day, you're following my plot line. And I don't know, like, I just feel like if he does want good and evil, like, you know, to be, like, contrasted, of course you can have, like, you know, your whole, like, oh, it has to be, like, you know, black and white, blah, blah, blah. But it's the fact that he doesn't care about Adam and Eve, and that's what's, like, getting me, in that, like, he doesn't care about the rest of the people. Like, if he was, like, it's such a shame that this has to happen, it's like when you put your dog down, you're like, oh,
I know he has to die, but I don't want this to happen. But it's for his own good, right? If he's like, if this is for Adam's own good, and I'm the master, and I know, like, you know, all of this, and, you know, it's so sad, but we get, like, no indication that, like, God is, like, again, remorseful, or, like, at least, like, sorry. Like, you know, it's just, he's kind of like, yeah, this is happening, and you're going to go through it, and that's what I decided, and I'm not going to change my mind about it.
Okay, Craig, and then Elijah.
Well, I think exactly like you do, but I believe that Milton is, he says he's trying to justify God, but I would be surprised if he's really trying to justify, like we discussed, Satan and demons, because the way he portrays them is in an amazing light. I mean, you have a warrior saying, like, oh, we should go back and fight no matter what. It's a really, like, courageous thing to do. Even if they know they can't beat a god, they're still going back to fight a god that can't win. You have another guy who's extremely rational and uses really great logic, saying, no, we should wait. Maybe God will have mercy on us. And then we have some other guy saying, well, let's do, like, a backhanded revenge against someone we can't. It's extremely logically planned. Whereas the way you're describing book three is it's really, like she said, it's just kind of like a really decisive, rude way to treat something you created as something that's supposed to be good, something that's supposed to be like your image, maybe not literal image, but in the idea that they create, they do things like a god. But clearly Satan, Belial, Beelzebub, and other, they're all really respectable people, even in their own weird way. I can respect a warlord who wants to fight war and be courageous. I can't respect a god who created something and wants it to suffer.
Okay, yeah, so, okay, Elijah.
I haven't read Paradise Lost before, so I don't really know how it reads when Milton retells the story, but I know there are a lot of, like, biblical commentators who read the God of the Old Testament as, like, an incredibly insecure and jealous character.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if that would sort of do some of the work.
God calls himself jealous in the Old Testament.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, or, like, the Lord thy God is a jealous God.
Yeah.
Visiting iniquity on them that hate him even unto the fourth and fifth generations.
The way he tests Job in the beginning of the book seems really insecure.
Well, that's Satan, though.
Yeah. No, but he agrees to it.
Yeah.
Satan's like, Job doesn't really love you. And he's yeah. like, oh no, what if Job doesn't really love me?
Yeah.
anyway, I wonder if that would do some of the explaining of, like, it's not the fact that God doesn't have the empathy, it's that when you are feeling, like, when characters feel insecure, the, like, ability to empathize with the person who might hurt them goes down. You need to sort of fortify yourself for the blow. God's preparing for the betrayal. I don't know how to read the Milton out, but that's the way of reading the Old Testament at least.
Yeah, okay.
But if God, like, knows everything, I mean, God is, like, omnipotent, like, the most powerful being in the world, he should know that Job would never betray him. Like, if he knows everything, that's, like, it's just weird. Like, if he's all powerful, he should know, like, or be able to, like, I don't know, future sight, like a prophet or something. Like, you know, he should know that, like, even if, like, he did this test, Job would still be, like, loyal. And that, like, you know, despite it all, like, Job loved God a lot. And so, like, I don't know, like, I feel like a lot of this stuff could be, like, whimsy. But, like, I
whimsy, did you say? That's,
like,
great.
Whimsy.
Yeah.
But, like, I also have, like, never read the Testament or really gotten into the Bible like that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just think that the idea that God's all-knowing is, like, it's not, like, native to the Old Testament. Like, it might be there in some sort of subtle ways, but it's not, like, obvious to the God of the Old Testament is supposed to be all-knowing. I think that's, like, a very late and, like, a very Christian imposition on the Old Testament. So I don't know.
All right, so what's really interesting about this is that people are arguing about the biblical God and possibly the real God. In ways that are relevant to what Milton is trying to think through. But Milton is creating this character of God. And so let me just tell you basically what he does. Now I'll try to give it to you from the pro-God point of view. So what you're saying is that God should be experiencing certain emotions, should be having certain feelings, and so on. There is a doctrine that Milton flirts with, or Adam flirts with towards the end of Paradise Lost, which is the doctrine known as the happy fall. It's in Latin. It's the, do you know what it is in Latin? It's the Felix culpa. Felix is happy. Do people know that? Like someone's name, like Felix the cat means the happy cat. So Felix is the Latin word for happy, and culpa is sin, as in when you're culpable or of something. So the happy sin or the happy fall. And that idea goes back to Augustine. And the idea, and I'll just tell you, it was picked up in a pun. Do people know that James Joyce's last novel, Finnegan's Wake, is the most insane document of punning ever written? It's really hard, but it's really hard because every word is a pun. And lots of the puns are not that great. Some yes, some not so much. But what happens in Finnegan's Wake is that the main male character, who is known by his initials, he's got various different ways that he's being called, but you can tell it's him because he has the initials HCE, asks a girl that is someone under 18 in Phoenix Park what time it is, but she thinks that he's coming on to her. So she reports him to the police. So this is to the extent there's a plot in Finnegan's Wake, this is part of the plot. And he is then, the name of the park where this happens is the largest urban park in the world, which is Phoenix Park in Dublin. And the River Liffey runs right through it. And if you get yourself a real Guinness, unlike the swill that you can get here, it's unfiltered Liffey water in the Guinness, and you can taste the mud. So at one point, there's a reason that I'm telling you this little thing, is one of the puns applied to HCE, to this character who is asked the time, is the Phoenix culprit. So that's a typical pun in Finnegan's Wake on Felix culpa, the Phoenix culprit. So that's a real thigh slapper, right? Yeah, we should all laugh, and then Ilanish will wonder what was so funny. Isn't that great?
Did you finish reading Finnegan's Wake?
I did my senior thesis on it.
Like in college?
Yeah.
Do you like James Joyce a lot? Or?
Not as much as I used to. I was obsessed back then. Yeah.
I tried Ulysses this summer and I stopped 20 pages in.
No, yeah, I tried Finnegan's Wake. I got 11 pages in and I couldn't.
Yeah, I'm not reading it again. But unless I have a professor doing it with me, but I can't do it myself.
What was that, Sherman?
No, it was Ulysses. I tried reading myself, just sitting there.
David Sherman teaches a course in Ulysses, so yeah, it's worth taking. And Paul Morrison used to, but I don't know that he does anymore. At any rate, well, Ulysses, it is a great novel, but you should not start with Finnegan's Wake. Some of you may know, if you've read The Bell Jar,
Sylvia Plath,
her narrator in The Bell Jar is writing a senior thesis on Finnegan's Wake, and she hasn't started. And she's got a week left to go. You were nodding? Is that how you knew about it? Anyhow, she has a week left to go, and she's really got to start working on her senior thesis. So this might sound familiar to you, people who have a senior thesis due in a week who haven't started working on it yet. Or it may look familiar to you when you're a senior. So at any rate, she finally cracks open the book, and wow, is she in for a surprise. She has no idea what's going on. Just another thing about Finnegan's Wake, just the tiniest thing to know about it. It's got the most unlikely last word that you can imagine. Anyone know what the last word of the novel is? What could not be the last word of a novel? Yeah. No, you got it. It starts with the word River Run, a single word, River Run, uncapitalized. And then you read all 628 pages. Yeah, it is exactly 628 pages. you read all 628 pages and you get to the end, and it the last words are away, alone, a loved, along the. And yeah, and the idea is that you then go back to the beginning. It's a circular novel.
Yeah.
At any rate, the main male character is the Phoenix culprit, which goes back to the idea of the Felix culpa, the happy fool, and then this is going back to what you were saying. The idea is that being disobedient, man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, being disobedient leads to the fall of humanity, which leads to the sacrifice that the Son of God makes in order to redeem humanity, which leads us humans to really appreciate the love of God, that God, or in Milton, it's the Son of God, that the Son of God would do this for us. So we would have much less of an appreciation of God. This is what Augustine says. We would have much less of an appreciation of God. We wouldn't see how amazing God was that he would give his only begotten Son. Was it you who were doing John 3:16? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so can you quote it again?
For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believed in him shall not perish but have everlasting life.
Okay, great, exactly. So we wouldn't know that if we hadn't sinned. And it's because we've sinned that we can get the so that so can have its real meaning. God so loved the world that he gave us his only begotten Son so that we could live. He made this sacrifice. And if we had not sinned, we wouldn't know that sacrifice. And do anyone know the parable of the prodigal son? What is it? It's a four sentence parable.
Oh, I don't know the parable.
Okay, so what is the prodigal son?
So it's a story about this man who has two sons, and one of them is always hardworking and does a lot for the father, and the other one's really lazy and doesn't care. And then one day the lazy son goes off and runs away, and the other son is he stays there and he helps his father. And then the other son returns, and the son's expecting the father to be mad at him, but instead he, throws a feast for him and just welcomes him back.
Jesus is telling this parable to say there's more joy in the return of a sinner than in someone who's just been doing what they're supposed to do all the time. So the idea would be that the sin and then the redemption is actually a better experience. It's a deeper experience than those who are just drones all the time. So if Adam and Eve hadn't eaten the apple, then they wouldn't have had the experience of sin and they wouldn't have had the experience of salvation. And at the end of Paradise Lost, Adam says to Michael, who is showing him the future, "Now I wonder whether it wasn't a good thing that I ate the apple." And Michael said, "Yeah, maybe don't go there." But the point is that, yeah, maybe it is a good thing. So, but the idea there that it might be a good thing is that there's an experience of a sense of God's love and a sense of the depth of his love that you get if you see that he so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son for our salvation, sacrificed, let die. Or if you're a Trinitarian, which Milton was not, but if you believe that on some level that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are all three God, and that when you talk about God, you might be talking about any of those three. I'm trying to put this in a not too controversial way. Then you would say that God died for us. If Jesus Christ is Lord, which is what Christ means. Christ was not his last name. Christ means Jesus the Lord or Jesus God. if he is Lord, then he himself died for us. We did this, and he sacrificed himself for us. And if that's the case, then had we not eaten the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, we wouldn't have known not only the evil, but the good that comes out of that evil. So if that's the case, then the argument against the idea that God could have just stopped this all, or that he's playing kind of dumb, that is, I created them, I didn't know they were going to eat the fruit, and then they did. Or I created them, and I did know they would eat the fruit, and I did it anyhow, is that after the fall, we learn something about God that we didn't know before the fall. Not that he's evil, but that he is willing to sacrifice everything for us despite the fact that we treated him badly. So that's the angelic reading of Paradise Lost. It's interesting, a little bit hard to sustain, but again, this is just... You know, hopefully one day you'll read the whole thing, and this is to give you some sense of what is going to go on. What happens in book three of Paradise Lost, it takes place in heaven, and then we're going to return to Satan, but it takes place in heaven. And in book three of Paradise Lost, God says, of course, Adam and Eve are going to eat the fruit. And I know they are. One of the things the fallen angels argue about in hell is free will, fixed fate, foreknowledge absolute. So one of the things that happens in hell while they're waiting around, let me just see if I can find this quickly. It's in book two, is... probably not going to find this fast enough.
Is it their philosophizing?
Yeah, where is it?
560 of good and evil, much they argue then.
Yeah. Final. Okay, yeah, read it. Yeah, I don't know where, yeah.
Of good and evil, much they argue then, of happiness and final misery, passion and apathy, and glory and shame, vain wisdom all, and false philosophy. Yet, with a pleasing sorcery, could charm pain for a while, or anguish, and excite felicitous hope, or arm the obdurated breast with stubborn patience as a triple steel.
Right, and just before that, that's great, and just before that, what happens in hell is you have games, like Olympic games, so the more athletic of the fallen angels do some sports. Then you have the more artsy angels who sing songs and produce poetry. And then you have the more philosophical angels. So this is, if you have it, it's book 2, line 555. In discourse more sweet, for eloquence the soul, song charms the sense. That is, eloquence charms the soul, whereas song charms the sense. Others apart sat on a hill retired in thoughts more elevate and reasoned high of providence, foreknowledge, will, and fate. So here they want to see how they can reconcile all these things. Providence, foreknowledge, will, and fate. Fixed fate, free will, foreknowledge absolute, and found no end in wandering mazes lost. So how can you reconcile the ideas? How can all of these things be true? That fate is fixed, that the will is free, and that God's foreknowledge is absolute. So all three of those things are supposed to be true. Can all three be true? That's what the rebel angels don't see, how all three can be true. If fate is fixed, God's absolute foreknowledge. That is, he knows what's going to happen in the future. So that seems to mean that it has to happen. If he knows it's going to happen, it means it's fixed. It's going to happen, no matter what. So how do you have free will? That's what the rebel angels don't know. Yeah.
Well, on the same page, this is a little bit off topic, about the watery labyrinth that goes through. I thought that was a pretty cool analogy to, like, alcohol, probably, in, like, Britain. Because, like, whereof who drinks forwith his former state and being forgets both joy and grief, pleasure and pain.
Yeah.
And I was like, this could be a little, like, commentary on, I don't think there was many, like, opioids in
not yet, no.
16, whatever. But yeah. There was probably alcoholism.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's talking about that sort of, like, oh, there's this drink that is demonic in essence, and you can drink it and you can forget everything, or you cannot drink it and deal with the good and bad.
Yeah, and that actually goes back all the way to Greek and Egyptian mythology. But yeah, it is the idea that if you could drink something that would make you forget everything, would you do it? If you were in hell, you would, but they can't. But here's the question. Free will, fixed fate, foreknowledge, absolute. So in book three, God says, he demonstrates his absolute foreknowledge. There are Adam and Eve, and you know what they're doing on earth, it turns out, while God is saying this? They're singing hymns to him. They are singing hymns of gratitude to him, we find out in book five. They're singing hymns of gratitude to God, just as he's saying, look at those assholes on earth. And so Milton, if he's defending God, he's making that defense as hard as he possibly can. And why are they assholes? Because God knows what they're going to do. And if he knows what they're going to do, how do they have free will and why should they be blamed? That's what the rebel angels are going to ask. He gives a two-line answer, which is, he says, yeah, I know what they're going to do, but they would have done it whether I knew it or not. It would have proved, yet would have proved a certain unforeknown. The fact that I know they're going to do it doesn't mean that they weren't free to do something else. It just means they won't do something else. So from God's perspective, they freely choose to do something, and then he knows what it is. But he claims that they didn't have to, that it was their own free will, and that if they didn't have free will, then they wouldn't be fully human. So he had to create all the angels and all the humans as beings with free will. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like to understand this, you have to think about, like, the reason why Adam ate the apple and how, like, Eve, like, she was tricked, but, like, with Adam, he saw her eat it and was like, I know this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway, like, for you, which is, like, human nature. Like, he's picking, like, this love of Eve over, like, his own well-being and his own, like, life.
Yeah.
And I think that's what God is trying to say. Like, they're doing it, like, yes, like, I know it's going to happen because I understand what humans will do, not because it's, like, predestined.
Yeah.
And I really like that speech that Adam gives before he eats the apple, too. And I feel like Adam's written as a pretty, like, unlikable character throughout.
Until then.
Until then. Really built him off.
Okay, yeah, so what... So we're going through all of it. You should read this whole poem. It's amazing. Eve eats the apple because she thinks, she's convinced by Satan that God is testing her. And as I said before, one reason that she is brought to think that God is testing her is God has tested Adam in exactly the same way. So God says to Adam, you don't need anybody else. You're fine. Look at me. I'm alone. Which is a lie, by the way, because God is in heaven with the Son and with all the loyal angels and so on. But he appears to Adam and says, look at me, I'm alone. And you should be fine being alone too. So Adam says, no. You're God, I'm not. you can stand being alone, I really can't. And God then says, Adam, you did it. I was testing to see whether you would make that point rather than just be blindly obedient to me. And you passed the test, you weren't blindly obedient. The question about whether you should be blindly obedient to God, what biblical story does that question come up most famously in?
Abraham
sacrificing Isaac. So lots of people think Abraham failed that test because he didn't object to God's demand that he sacrifice Isaac. But God says he passed the test. So there's one version of God, which is, yes, you have to be blindly obedient. But in Paradise Lost, God says, it's really good that you weren't blindly obedient, but that you actually asked me why you had to be alone. And so you pass the test, and your reward is Eve behind door number three. So he gets Eve, he gets sex, she gets sex, they get happiness. It's all good. Now the serpent says to Eve, God is obviously testing you. It'd be really, really stupid. And what would God be like if he cared whether you ate an apple or not? Is that your idea of God? That he's someone who's just really worried about whether you're going to eat an apple? Seriously? And Eve says, yeah, that makes sense. And so she eats the apple, and it turns out, yeah, he really did not want her to eat the apple. So now she's in trouble, and she kind of feels it. She's worried about it. Then Adam comes along. They've been separated since 9 a.m. It's now noon. Adam comes along, and she says to Adam, this apple is great. And he says, what? And she says, no, really, you should have it. And then he thinks, should I have the apple or not? And he looks at her and thinks of the alternatives, and then he says, should God create another Eve and I a second rib afford, yet loss of thee would never from my heart. And then he says, certain, my resolution is to die. So he eats the apple, knowing that it will cause his death. Kind of like Juliet dying after Romeo has died. He does it in full. Romeo's a moron. He should not have killed himself. He looks, do people know this? He looks at Juliet, they're doing it somewhere. He looks at Juliet and he says, wow, it's like she's alive. I can't believe it. I thought she was dead, but she looks like she's alive. Must be because death wants to have sex with her and so is preserving her, but I'm going to stop that by dying myself. So it's just the stupidest thing imaginable. She's just about to wake up. And Romeo says, she's so beautiful. She looks like she's alive. I better kill myself quickly. He kills himself. And then Juliet wakes up, does wake up, and says, he actually killed himself, and he really is dead. And then she does it in full knowledge. One of the things about Romeo and Juliet is that Romeo is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and Juliet is super sharp. She's much, much smarter than Romeo. It's one of the fascinating things about the play. So same thing is happening here, which is that Adam says, I'm going to die for you, to be with you, because you matter so much to me. And he knows exactly what he's doing, which she didn't. So two different reasons for eating the apple. Adam's reason is not the same as Eve's reason. Okay, the reason, my reason for bringing that up, is that what happens in book three is God says, man with all his progeny must die, with all his posterity must die, he and his posterity must die. And then he says, kind of strangely, he comes up with this little rule or motive or reason. He says, die he or justice must. So if man doesn't die, then justice will die. So someone's got to die, either justice or man. Die he or justice must, he says. Okay, so it'd be unjust for him to live. Got it. He's like Scalia or something, some Supreme Court justices, or not justices. That justice died. Okay. He's got an idea there. Die he or justice must. If he gets away with it, then justice will die. So your view might be, so let justice die. But that's not God's view. Die he or justice must. And then he says something really weird, which is, unless another is ready and as willing and as able, will die in his stead. So if someone else will die, then Adam can live and justice will also live. Okay, you all who are judging whether Milton is justifying God's ways to men, does that really make sense? It seems like a pretty strange equivalence. As long as somebody dies, justice will be served, even if it's someone innocent who dies, so that someone guilty does not die.
That's like having someone on the death penalty and then being like, well, as long as someone sits in the chair, we're all good, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And in fact, there have been appeals court justices who've made that claim, that the demand for punishment in some heinous crimes are so great that the fact that someone is actually, may turn out to be actually innocent, that is, you can prove that they're innocent through DNA or something, isn't enough not to execute them. This has actually been argued in U.S. courts. Not argued, this has been the opinion of justices, judges in U.S. courts. So it's just people are so pissed that this little girl died, that someone's got to pay. But this person's obviously innocent. Tough. Someone's got to pay. So it's one of the sleazier parts of our psychology is that we sometimes feel that way. And most of the time we're wise enough not to feel that way. But sometimes it just breaks out even into the public discourse of judges on a court of appeals. Yep.
Is Adam the only one that's supposed to die in God's eyes, or are you two?
No, and humanity.
Oh, so yeah, Adam's figurehead of death should. So it's almost like death, Satan releasing death
into the world.
Yeah, is kind of God land.
Yes. So yeah. Absolutely.
In book three, he mentioned something like, "Oh, like let it go," because like it's his choice anyways.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so then he goes on and he says, who's going to pay? Then he says, but, you know, if someone else were willing to do it, then it would be okay. But is there anyone who would pay the rigid satisfaction death for death? Which really is bizarre. But then the son says, and the son, this is one of the cool things about Paradise Lost, is that he is always managing his father. It's like his father is just such a jerk, but the son is always rephrasing what his father has just said and then praising him for the rephrased version. So the Son of God says, he doesn't have a name in Paradise Lost. You know him as Jesus, but that's his name on earth. It's not his name in heaven. The Son of God says, Father, that's so cool that you are going to allow humans to live. And God had said the rigid satisfaction death for death. The son says, I volunteer life for life. Now, it sounds like the same thing. I'm giving my life for him. But as soon as he switches it from death for death to life for life, he opens a thin end of a wedge, which is he's saying it's all about life, not about death. And what he then says is, because I know that when I give my life for him, you, being such a great God, aren't going to cause me to be dead forever. but you'll bring me back to heaven after I've saved humanity. And God basically goes, huh, yeah, I guess that is what I meant. Which is not what he meant. At least I don't think it's what he meant. At any rate, it's a bizarre thing to say, die here, justice must, that makes sense. But what's strange about it is that he's taking, and we're going to get to metaphor in this class, so notice it's a metaphor. If you say, it's a pretty cool rhetorical trick to say either he dies or justice does. Anyone know what Oscar Wilde's last words were? Do you know who Oscar Wilde is? All right. His last words were, he's lying in bed. He's a real aesthete. He's lying in bed, and his last words were, he's facing the wall. He says, either that wallpaper goes or I do. So he went. So the same thing, same sort of metaphor. Die he or justice must. It's that humans will die literally or justice will figuratively die. But then, having said that, he says, unless someone else is willing to die instead. So what he's done is he's used a metaphor to say, it's a trick. He's used a metaphor to say, a metaphor we all understand, die here, justice must, which means one or another thing must die. And then he says, okay, so if it turns out you can substitute one death for another, the death of justice for the death of humanity, we would never do that, but that introduces the idea that you can substitute one death for another. And so now we substitute the death of the Son of God for the death of humanity. And that substitution, which made no sense, would have made no sense to the angels, now starts making sense once they accept the kind of logical trick of saying die he or justice must. It's a trick like, you know, the three people who go to a hotel and it's $9 a night for the rooms, but they you know this math thing that can get people all fussy about, so they get $2 in change, but what happened to the extra dollar, etc. It's a trick like that. It's a logical trick where there's a kind of sleight of hand that's occurring because of a metaphor. Okay, all of this is to get us back to Satan. Because in book four, or to get us back to what Milton thinks about Satan. Because in book four, Satan comes to Eden, and he sees Adam and Eve in the garden. And he says, he falls in love with them. And he says, they are so beautiful and so innocent. And he says, he looks at them and he says, I look at them with wonder and I could love them. So beautiful they are. And then he says, ah, gentle pair, ye little think how nigh your change approaches. And he says, I am doing something that I have to do because of the situation, but I would find it, otherwise I would abhor it, what I'm about to do, which is to trick them into falling. And then the narrator of Paradise Lost says, so he appealed to, it's another great line in Paradise Lost, to necessity, the tyrant's plea. It's always tyrants who say that it is necessary to do something. I don't want to do it. It's really bad that we have to do this. But we have no choice. And what Milton is saying is it's tyrants who say they have no choice. That is the bizarre paradox. That tyrants who have absolute power are the ones who claim to have no power at all. They have to do this. They have no choice. So when the narrator of Paradise Lost is talking about Satan, he's willing to say that necessity is the tyrant's plea. But when God says, die he or justice must, he's saying the same thing. He's saying it has to happen. I have no choice. I have absolute power, but I have no choice. So, again, a way to think about Paradise Lost, I mean, partly what I'm trying to do is to suggest to you that Paradise Lost is just an amazing work. Not even if it's corny, it's an amazing work. And it is by no means predictable where it's going to go or what its views are. But what Milton has done then is he has demonstrated through a parallel that God does something and Satan does the same thing. And when Satan does it, it's kind of like Herschel Walker, when Satan does it, then the narrator can say, no, this was wrong, wrong, wrong. How can Satan do such a thing? But the narrator, not Milton, but the narrator has kind of forgotten that God has done the exact same thing. So that's Milton's way, perhaps, of criticizing God by having Satan mirror what God does, and then he criticizes Satan. So that mirroring begins with sin coming out of Satan's head. This is how we got here, which is that sin comes out of Satan's head, and thyself and me, thy perfect image viewing, says sin, and that idea that the Son is the perfect image of God comes straight out of God. This day I have begot whom I declare my only Son, and is the perfect image of God. Sin is the perfect image of Satan. Eve is comes right out of Adam. That those three pairings should all allow for a analysis via parallels. If Satan acts in a certain way to sin, and God acts in the same way to the Son, then it becomes hard to say that Satan is just being sinful if God isn't. If God acts in a certain way and says it's absolutely necessary that humanity dies, and then Satan says really the same thing in Book 4, it's necessary that humanity dies. He appeals to what he calls public reason just. That is the justice of public reason. So he even uses the term just. And the narrator says, look how bad that is. Then it's going to be, he's kind of fallen into a trap, which is you can't distinguish what God is doing from what Satan is doing at that moment. They're both saying it has to happen even though it makes me unhappy. And even though it doesn't have to happen, but justice demands that it happens.
I've been, while reading this, a little curious about like the meter behind Paradise Lost. Is it following the same as other epic poems, like the Deca?
No, it's iambic pentameter.
Okay. And
that's why we're doing it.
Okay, does he ever use rhyme at all? Is there even like a little...
In other poems, yeah. In Paradise Lost, arguably. There are famous essays about whether there's occasional rhyme in Paradise Lost. Almost never a couplet, or never anything that could look like a couplet. But sometimes they're rhyming words fairly near each other. So it's a good question. But what he says in the note on the verse is rhyme is bad. Nevertheless, there are places where it does flirt with rhyme.
And so why does he use those, like, over the E, he wants you to accent it sometimes?
Well, it's not he, it's the printer.
Oh, so it doesn't really matter.
I mean, it's the editor. Yeah.
Oh, okay. This is weird. I'm like,
well, one thing that the original printing does is sometimes the word me or the word he has two E's in it and sometimes one. And if it's got two E's, it's certainly going to be emphasized. So the Son, for example, says, on me let all thy rage fall. And that's M-E-E, me. There you know. Milton dictated the poem. He was blind. and he dictated it to his daughters. Yeah.
Wasn't he like really mean to the daughters? And he would like say it in like a language that he wouldn't let them like learn, so they didn't even know what they were writing.
Possibly. Not Paradise Lost, but what he did was he taught them to read, to be able to read Hebrew and Greek, but not to understand what they were reading.
Yeah, okay. I remember learning that in high school.
Yeah, so they would read Greek out loud to him, and he knew what they were saying, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But apparently they didn't actually complain about this. Oh. So I think he's probably not he would not be a pleasant person to spend a lot of time with. But he is an amazing poet. Okay, so what... let's go back to... well, you don't have it with you. There was one passage that I did want us to look at, but... So you'll all read the first two books. We have 5 minutes. You'll all read the first two books for, if you haven't, you'll all read them for Tuesday. Yeah.
I don't think we have class Tuesday. It might be a Brandeis Monday. Question?
No, it's a week from Tuesday, I think, is a Brandeis Monday.
Next Thursday is Brandeis.
That's Thursday.
Oh, okay.
What does that mean?
Do we have class on Tuesday?
Well, it's the Monday schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we do.
Yeah.
Monday,
though.
Yeah.
I have no classes.
Yeah, it's on the syllabus, but I don't have the syllabus with me. Which classes we don't have, but I'm pretty sure we have class Tuesday.
Okay.
Like I'm positive.
Okay.
I mean, you can be wrong when you're positive, but I'm positive. Okay. All right, let us look just to talk about iambic pentameter. Look at the passage that we were already looking at, which is the... just trying to think if we should do this or not. Is this the region, this the soil, the clime?
Do you know what line it is?
I'll tell you. It's book one, line 242.
Thank you.
So this is what we were already looking at. Is this the region, this the soil, the clime, said then the lost archangel, this the seat that we must change for heaven, this mournful gloom for that celestial light. No, this is another good example of the way the natural stress that we would give to a word. Actually, this is going to take too long, so I'm going to give you one more idea from linguistics. So there's something in linguistics called the 13 men effect. So that's its technical name. It turns out it doesn't Google, which I don't understand why, but there is something called the 13 men effect. So if I were to ask you how many people were at the Last Supper, what would you say?
13.
Wait, louder?
13.
Okay. I am or Trochee? I don't think so. How many men at the Last Supper?
But you don't say 13. You go 13.
Okay. All right. Okay. How about let's count from 10 to 18. So let's all do it together. 10, 11, 12, 13,
14, 15.
Okay. No, those are trochees. 13, 14, 15. How old were you when you bar mitzvahed?
13.
Do you hear the difference? You'll sometimes say 13.
I also say 14.
Yeah, or 14.
Oh, 14.
Yeah, no. But if you're counting, you'll say 12, 13, 14. Just hear the difference between, or tell me which I'm thinking of. I'm only going to give you the one word. So I'm either thinking the sentence, there were a certain number of people at the Last Supper, or I am thinking, I am just counting 12, etc. Okay, so there were, oh, sorry, so 13.
Dinner.
Okay. 13.
Yeah, I see that.
Okay?
Yeah.
So 13 means I'm counting. Mm-hmm. 13 means that I'm giving the number of people at the Last Supper. So the same word is sometimes an I am and sometimes a troche.
That's weird.
And it will depend on the syntactic context that it appears in. So here we're not talking about two different words like content and content. Here we're talking about the exact same word, the number 13. Or is it the number 13? Well, no, it's the number 13. That's how we would say it, right? What number? The number 13. How many times do I have to say this? I've told you 13 times that 13 is an I am. So it's the same word with different stresses depending on its context. So what we were talking about before, which is the overlay of natural stress with meter, will partly depend on context. So that's just something to keep in mind. Okay, finish and bring in the first two books of Paradise Lost for Tuesday. I have returned every paper that I've received. So at least I believe I have. So if you handed in a paper but haven't gotten it back yet, let me know. Okay, have a good weekend. See you Tuesday.